morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We are halfway through the two interloping Caesarean months of summer. Julius, Vini Vidi Vici, has been liquidated for another year, and we are now in the third day of the Leonine reign of Augustus. As a nation, we continue to suffer the outrages of a would-be Caesar, a two-faced Caligula Nero monstrosity of decrepit mendacity and virulent narcissism, whose reign already resembles an insane asylum, which prompts a line from the Depression-era movie My Man Godfrey, spoken by the gravelly-voiced Eugene Pallette. All you need to start an insane asylum is an empty room and the right kind of people. Which in turn inspires a question the late Ben Bradley, famous editor of the Washington Post during the Watergate mess, asked about the earlier infamous Senator Joseph McCarthy, and must also have asked about Richard Nixon. How does America get rid of somebody like that? The question is more than ever being asked across the country. Naomi Klein endeavors an answer with a new book, No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need, from which much of today's program has been taken. She writes that her book's argument, in a nutshell, is that Trump, extreme as he is less an aberration than a logical conclusion, a pastiche of pretty much all the worst trends of the past half century. Trump, she says, is the product of powerful systems of thought that rank human life based on race, religion, gender, sexuality, physical appearance, and physical ability, and that have systematically used race as a weapon to advance brutal economic policies since the earliest days of North American colonization and the transatlantic slave trade. He is also, she writes, the personification of the merger of humans and corporations, with all the pathologies and conflicts of interest inherent in that. For today, I will read her final chapter of No Is Not Enough. And I dedicate today's program to Kate Brister, who has recorded my radio rants over a telephone for the past 2 years on Wednesday mornings for broadcast Thursdays. She has left KMUN and Oregon to care for family, which I hope is not for too long. And now, No Is Not Enough by Naomi Klein, with a couple of quotes, the first by Jean-Claude Servais. The hour calls for optimism. We'll save pessimism for better times. And from Myrna Loy, life is not having, is not a having and a getting, but is a being and a becoming. It is her birthday yesterday. She was born August 2nd, 1905, Myrna Loy. A state of shock is produced when a story is ruptured, when we have no idea what is going on. But in so many ways, Donald Trump is not a rupture at all, but rather the culmination, the logical endpoint, of a great many dangerous stories our culture has been telling for a very long time. That greed is good, that the market rules, that money is what matters in life, that white men are better than the rest, that the natural world is there for us to pillage, that the vulnerable deserve their fate, and the 1% deserve their golden towers, that anything public or commonly held is sinister and not worth protecting, that we are surrounded by danger and should only look after our own, that there is no alternative to any of this. Given these stories are, for many of us, part of the very air we breathe, Trump really should not come as a shock. A billionaire president who boasts he can grab women by their genitals while calling Mexicans rapists and jeering at the disabled is the logical expression of a culture that grants indecent levels of impunity to the ultra-rich, that is consumed with winner-take-all competition, and that is grounded in dominance-based logic at every level. We should have been expecting him. And indeed, many of those directly touched by the underbelly of Western racism and misogyny have been expecting him for a long time. So maybe the emotion beneath what some have been calling shock is really, more accurately, horror. specifically the horror of recognition that we feel when we read effective dystopian fiction or watch good dystopian films. All stories of this genre take current trends and follow them to their obvious conclusion, then use that conclusion to hold up a mirror and ask, do you like what you see? Do you really want to continue down this road? These nightmare futures are horrifying precisely because they are not shocking, not a break with our underlying stories, but their fulfillment. I have come to believe that we should see America's first nuclear-armed reality TV president in a similar fashion, as dystopian fiction come to life. Trump is a mirror, held up not only to the United States but to the world. If we don't like what we see, and throngs of us clearly do not, then it is clear what we need to do. We have to question not only Trump, but the stories that ineluctably produced him. It is not enough to superficially challenge him as an individual, foul and alarmingly ignorant though he may be. We have to confront the deep-seated trends that rewarded him and exalted him until he became the most powerful person in the world. The values that have been sold to us through reality TV, get-rich-quick books, billionaire saviors, philanthro-capitalists. The same values that have been playing out in destroyed safety nets, exploding prison numbers, normalized rape culture, democracy-destroying trade deals, rising seas and privatized disaster response, and in a world of green zones and red zones. At the same time, perhaps it's okay, healthy even, for us just to be a little bit shocked by Trump. Here's why. Those stories that produced him were always contested. There were always other stories, ones that insisted that money is not all that is valuable, and that all of our faiths are intertwined with one another and with the health of the rest of the natural world. The forces Trump represents have always had to suppress those other, older, and self-evidently true stories so that theirs could dominate against so much intuition and evidence. The persistence of these other stories should remind us that while Trump is the logical culmination of the current neoliberal system, the current neoliberal system is not the only logical culmination of the human story. Which is why part of our work now, a key part, is not just resistance, not just saying no. We have to do that, of course, but we also need to fiercely protect some space to dream and plan for a better world. This is not an indulgence. It is an essential part of how we defeat Trumpism. Trump's rise has also prompted a more internal kind of challenge, which might sound a bit strange, the necessary determination to kill the inner Trump in each of us. We have already seen that the new regime in Washington has led a great many people to try to understand and overcome our own latent biases and prejudices, the ones that have kept us divided in the past. This internal work is crucial as we come together in resistance and transformation. There are some other, often overlooked ways that many of us can do more to confront our inner Trump, something, anything, that is just a little Trumpish in our habits. And to be clear, these omissions do not make all of us responsible for the outcome of the 2016 elections. This is not about who voted for whom and why. Maybe it's part whose attention span is fracturing into 140 characters and that is prone to confusing followers with friends. Maybe it's the part that has learned to see ourselves as brands in the marketplace rather than as people in communities. Or the part that sees other people doing similar work not as potential allies in a struggle that will need all our talents, but as rival products competing for scarce market share. Given that Trump's presidency is the culmination of corporate branding's insidious colonial logic, perhaps it is past time to leave all that behind. Or maybe it's the part that can't resist joining a mob to shame and attack people with whom we disagree, sometimes using cruel personal slurs with an intensity set to nuclear. At the very risk of bringing on these kinds of attacks, is it possible that this habit, too, is uncomfortably close to the tweeter-in-chief? Or maybe it's the part that is waiting for a billionaire to ride to the rescue, except this one will be kind and generous and concerned about climate change and empowerment for girls. The liberal billionaire savior may appear very far from Trump, but the fantasy still equates great wealth with superhero powers, which, once again, is just a little too close for comfort to the ministry of Mar-a-Lago. If some of these impulses and stories seem hardwired inside us, it is not because we are terrible people. It is because so many of us function within systems that are constantly telling us there are not enough resources for everyone to thrive, so we had better elbow our way to the top, whatever the cost. Willingly or not, anyone who consumes and produces media swims in the cultural waters of reality TV and personal branding and nonstop attention-splintering messages, the same waters that produce Donald Trump. There are different parts of that fetid swimming pool, to be sure, and some people are in zones with no lifeguards and with way more waterborne diseases than others, but it is still hard to get genuinely outside the pool. Recognizing this can help clarify our task. To have a hope of changing the world, we are going to have to be willing to change ourselves. Because we can try to fight the global rise of right-wing demagoguery in two possible ways. There is the establishment option embraced by centrist parties the world over. This promises a little more than child care, better representation of women and people of color at the top, and maybe a few more solar panels. But this option also comes with the same old austerity logic, the same blind faith in markets, the same equation of endless consumption with happiness, the same band-aids on gaping wounds. There are many reasons why this limited vision is utterly failing to stop the surge of the far right around the world. But the main one is this. It does not have nearly enough to offer. It does nothing to address the real and legitimate grievances that supercharge the search for scapegoats, nor does it give the people most endangered by the rising right enough hope for a better future. A society with extreme inequality, unmasked neo-fascist tendencies, and an unraveling climate is sick, and neoliberalism, as one of the main drivers of all these crises, is grossly inadequate medicine. It offers only a weak no to the forces responsible, and it lacks a yes worth seizing. A great many of us are clearly ready for another approach, a captivating yes that lays out a plan for tangible improvements in daily life, unafraid of powerful words such as redistribution and reparation, and intent on challenging Western culture's equation of a good life with ever-escalating creature comforts inside ever more isolated creature cocoons, never mind what the planet can take or what actually leads to our deepest fulfillment. And perhaps we should thank Trump for this newfound ambition, at least in part. The shamelessness of his corporate coup has done a tremendous amount to make systemic change seem even more necessary. If titans of American industry can eagerly line up behind this man with all of his ugly hatreds, his venality, vanity, and vacuousness, and if Wall Street can cheer on news of his plans to let the planet burn and the elderly starve, and if so much of the media can praise his cruise missiles ordered over chocolate cake as presidential, well then a great many people are coming to the conclusion that they want no part of a system like that. With this elevation of the basest of figures to the most exalted of positions, the culture of maximum extraction, of endless grabbing and disposing, has reached some kind of breaking point. Clearly, it is the culture itself that must be confronted now, and not policy by policy, but at the root. What we have seen with insurgent left candidacies and parties in the United States, France, and elsewhere are not perfect politicians or perfect platforms that have everything figured out. Some of the figures who have led these runs sound more like the past than the future, and the campaigns they have built often do not mirror the diverse countries they seek to govern, or at least not enough. And yet the very fact that these long-shot candidates and often brand-new political formations are coming within an arm's reach of power repeatedly stunning pollsters and establishment analysts is proof of a very important fact, one that has been denied and suppressed for the many decades of neoliberalism's stranglehold on public discourse. Progressive transformational change is popular, more than many of us would have dared imagine as recently as just 1 or 2 years ago. Here is what needs to be understood in our bones. The spell of neoliberalism has been broken, crushed under the weight of lived experience and a mountain of evidence. What for decades was unsayable is now being said out loud by candidates who win millions of votes. Free college tuition, double the minimum wage, 100% renewable energy as quickly as technology allows, demilitarize the police, prisons are no place for young people, refugees are welcome here, war makes us all less safe. And the crowds are roaring their agreement. With so much encouragement, who knows what's next? Reparations for slavery and colonialism, a Marshall Plan to fight violence against women, prison abolition, democratic workers' co-ops as the centerpiece of a green jobs program, an abandonment of growth as a measure of progress. Why not? The intellectual fencing that has constrained the progressive imagination for so long is lying twisted on the ground. The left-wing almost wins of the past 2 years are not defeats. They are the first tremors of a profound ideological realignment from which a progressive majority could well emerge. Just as geopolitically significant as the rise of authoritarianism and neo-fascism on the right side of the spectrum. Indeed, the weaknesses and missteps of these left candidates should be a cause not for despair, but for genuine hope. It means that a much larger political tent is possible. It is just a matter of collectivity and carefully planting the right poles from day one. As many movement leaders are now arguing, a very good start would be accepting the premise that widening economic inequality and climate disaster are inseparable from systems that have always ranked human life based on race and gender, while the capacity to pit populations against each other based on skin color, religious faith, and sexuality has been the single most potent tool for protecting and sustaining this lethal order. And if the political formation that has the guts to say all that also has a bold plan for humanizing and democratizing new technologies and global trade, then it would quickly seize back populist ground from the right, while feeling less like a blast from the past and more like a path to an exciting, never-before-attempted future. A deeply diverse and insistently forward-looking campaign like that could well prove unbeatable. If this sounds overly optimistic, remember, in the United States, the number of people showing up to join political movements is swelling to levels beyond anything organizers say they have seen. Marches for women's rights, against deportations, and in defense of black lives are seeing record numbers. Progressive political meetings, lectures, town halls, and assemblies are experiencing beyond capacity participation. Something powerful is at work, and anyone who claims to know how far this can go should be trusted about as much as the pollsters who told us Trump could never win and Brexit would certainly fail. Building this broad tent in a time of siloed politics is hard work, requiring a willingness to honestly confront painful histories before progress is possible. And yet in this moment that combines such fearsome stakes with such fertile potential, what choice do we have but to try, to leap at every new opportunity as it opens? Just one last reminder. Trump's disaster capitalists control a very powerful part of the U.S. government, but they do not control everything. They do not control what cities and states do. They do not even control what Congress does a lot of the time. They certainly do not control what the courts do, yet. They do not control what other sovereign nations do, and they do not control what we do as individuals and in groups around the world. Precisely because what is happening in Washington is so exquisitely dangerous, what all of us to do with our collective power in these non-Trumpified spaces matters now more than ever. At the 2016 Democratic National Convention, Michelle Obama memorably told the crowd that when they go low, we go high. She was talking less about deeds than about tone, and her family's refusal to join Trump and his gang in the gutter. It is time to transfer that ethos from tone to deeds. When they go low, everyone needs to aim high. For decades, elites have been using the power of shock to impose nightmares. Donald Trump thinks he will be able to do it again and again, that we will have forgotten by tomorrow what he said yesterday, which he will say he never said, that we will be overwhelmed by events and will ultimately scatter, surrender, and let him grab whatever he wants. But crises, as we have seen, do not always cause societies to regress and give up. There is also the second option, that faced with a grave common threat, we can choose to come together and make an evolutionary leap. We can choose, as the Reverend William Barber puts it, to be the moral defibrillators of our time and shock the heart of this nation and build a movement of resistance and hope and justice and love. We can, in other words, surprise the hell out of ourselves by being united, focused, and determined, by refusing to fall for those tired old shock tactics, by refusing to be afraid no matter how much we are tested. The corporate coup, in all its dimensions, is a crisis with global reverberations that could echo through geologic time. How we respond to this crisis is up to us. So let's choose that second option. Let's leap. And that was Naomi Klein from her book, No Is Not Enough. She is an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, documentary filmmaker, and author of such books as The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, and now, No Is Not Enough. And now, by L.A. Kaufman, the Trump resistance can best be described in one adjective, female. It has now been six dizzying and nauseating months since Donald Trump took the oath of office, and the brightest spot on the American political landscape is the grassroots resistance that has sprung up to counter his regime. No previous president ever faced so many protests so early in his term, and the millions who have taken to the streets since January can already take significant credit for stalling and frustrating key aspects of Trump's agenda, from his Muslim ban to his bid to repeal the Affordable Care Act. There are numerous qualities that distinguish this organizing upsurge from past waves of protest in the United States, but the most striking and significant is its composition. The resistance, by and large, is women. The movement kicked off, of course, with the massive women's marches in more than 650 cities and towns across the United States the day after the inauguration, which together added up to the single largest day of protest in American history. Women have anchored nearly every aspect of the resistance work since. Women made up a solid majority of those who marched on Washington time and again last spring. Sociologist Dana Fisher found, for instance, that 54% of participants in the People's Climate March and 57% of those who attended D.C.'s March on Science were women. A March survey of phone calls to congressional offices found an even more striking gender gap, with women constituting 86% of those making calls. Women have taken the lead in using stronger resistance tactics since the inauguration, from blocking Trump Tower in support of immigrant rights to holding sit-ins against Trump at Senate offices in Washington. And women have spearheaded many of the most noteworthy creative actions to counter the broader Trump agenda in recent months, from the Mama's Day bailout organized through the Movement for Black Lives Network in the spring to counter mass incarceration to the recent quinceañera-themed immigrant rights protest at the Texas State House organized by 15 young women in splendid poofy gowns. Though hard data is not available, all indications are that women predominate in the resistance movement's most distinctive expression, the thousands of small local groups that have sprung up all around the United States, including more than 5,800 groups aligned with Indivisible, the grassroots project launched by two former congressional staffers shortly after the November election. The women behind these ground level groups are often new to activism, but certainly not to life. Many are in their 40s and 50s, seasoned multitaskers with children or elderly parents, or both to care for alongside their other responsibilities. The sprawling movement they have helped build is emphatically decentralized, continuing a decades-long tradition in grassroots organizing. It is tactically nimble and refreshingly pragmatic. Resistance groups are working both outside and inside established channels, marching in the streets, while also registering voters and recruiting candidates to run for office. The gender makeup of the resistance is not adequate to explain these other movement characteristics, but it is clearly a factor to consider. Women, of course, have long played key but underacknowledged roles in the great movements of American history, from the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s to Ferguson and Standing Rock. With the anti-Trump resistance, though, the preponderance of women is so noteworthy and significant that failing to name it obscures the movement's basic nature and distorts the larger political conversation surrounding it. Why have so many articles, blog posts, and tweets invoked the resistance without acknowledging who is doing most of the day-to-day work of resisting? It might be because the majority of pundits, commentators, and advice givers on the left still come from the very demographic group that is so strongly unrepresented among the forces fighting Trump, men. If this disparity were more widely noted, just imagine how it might change discussions. Instead of debating whether the Democratic Party should be chasing after white male voters, we might be grappling instead with why men as a group have been comparatively so reluctant to march, organize, or even pick up the phone and make a simple call to Congress in response to the threat of Trump. In the meantime, each time Trump's agenda stalls and you find yourself thanking the resistance, remember who you are thanking. And that was by L.A. Kaufman, who is a longtime grassroots organizer and author of Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism, which was published this year. And the title of her piece, of course, The Trump Resistance, can best be described in one adjective: female. And as a postscript, disapproval of Donald Trump is not entirely by liberal-minded women alone. For example, a recent scathing description by Peggy Noonan, a former George W. Bush speechwriter. Quote, "The president's primary problem as a leader is not that he is impetuous, brash, or naive. It is not that he is inexperienced, crude, or an outsider. It is that he is weak and sniveling. It is that he undermines himself almost daily by ignoring traditional norms and forms of American masculinity. He's whiny, weepy, and self-pitying. He throws himself sobbing on the body politic. He's a drama queen." And that was Peggy Noonan. And at what might be considered the top of the pyramid of government, Trump has been defied by two other Republican women, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, who ignored his vile personal threats and thwarted his atrocious attempt to destroy Obamacare, at least for the present. So, you might fool most men most of the time, even all of the time, but he is not fooling the women. This has been Michael McCusker.